From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, filling in for Terry Gross. Yesterday, Saddam Hussein announced that he would sign an agreement granting autonomy for the Kurds. But how good is his word? And what are Hussein's possible motivations for the move? On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Los Angeles Times reporter Robin Wright about the agreement and the future of the Kurds. Also, what it means to be a third-generation Japanese-American on your first trip to Japan, from poet David Mura. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews Images of Chagall, the new recording by contemporary composer Meyer Kupferman. And commentator Maureen Corrigan tells us about photographer Annie Leibovitz's new exhibit. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First News.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Soviet Foreign Minister Alexander Besmertnik has indicated that Moscow is willing to join the United States in sponsoring a conference designed to solve the Arab-Israeli dispute. And he announced that he'd visit Israel next month. The BBC's Kevin Connolly reports from Moscow.
Mr. Baker has already reflected during his latest diplomatic mission that it's easier to obstruct peace than to promote it. But his hastily scheduled trip to Kislovodsk seems to have cleared away at least one further obstacle on the road to the convening of a conference on the future of the Middle East. Moscow is determined to retain some sort of role in the region, without appearing to act as Washington's junior partner in the wake of the Gulf War. The Americans have said that the Soviet Union could act as the co-host of a conference if it restored ties with Israel, broken off in 1967. Mr. Besmertnik hinted that contacts are now close to being re-established, and he said he planned to visit Israel next month during a tour of Middle Eastern capitals. Moscow has watched with concern as the United States has assumed the role of master of ceremonies in the Middle East, and it's stressing that it, too, has been sounding out its contacts in the region on the prospects for peace.
The BBC's Kevin Connolly. Iraq's UN ambassador said today that his country has withdrawn its security forces from the northern town of Zakho. Ambassador Abdul Al-Anbari said that only about 50 policemen have been left in the town where allied officials want to build camps for Kurdish refugees. Al-Anbari was responding to an order from the U.S., Britain, and France that said that all Iraqi security forces must be withdrawn from the town before the weekend. Two Colombian reporters were killed last night in Segovia, a mining town north of the city of Medellin. Unidentified assassins gunned down the reporters in the town's main street, just a few blocks from the police station. Leslie Werpsa has more from Bogota.
The two journalists had been working on a series of articles about rural towns abandoned after years of paramilitary and guerrilla violence. In Segovia, the town where they were murdered, 43 people were slaughtered in a single afternoon by a paramilitary death squad in November 1988. According to the church-related Justice and Peace Commission, 25 journalists were murdered in Colombia last year alone. Others have had to flee the country after receiving death threats. El Espectador, a muckraking newspaper known for its powerful stance against the drug traffickers and its investigative reports on paramilitary death squads, has been hard hit by violence. The paper's editor-in-chief, Guillermo Cano, was killed in 1986, and 2 years ago, a 500-pound bus bomb sacked the daily's headquarters in Bogota. For National Public Radio, I'm Leslie Wipsa in Bogota.
Stock prices were down today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrials lost 28 points to close at 2,921. Declines led advances 9-5 in active trading. This is NPR. The State Department has ordered all U.S. dependents and non-essential embassy personnel to leave Ethiopia. The order came along with confirmation that Ethiopian rebels have made significant military advances, including the capture of a strategic town about 65 miles from the capital. Diplomats in Addis Ababa said that the fall of the nearby town would probably create panic. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said that the U.S. is also recommending that private American citizens should leave as quickly as possible. Former Speaker of the House Thomas Tip O'Neill returned to Congress today to tell about his fight with cancer and press for more funding for cancer research. O'Neill testified at a hearing held by the Senate Labor and Human Resources Committee on the 20th anniversary of the National Cancer Act. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The former speaker was stricken with cancer of the colon in 1987 and was diagnosed as having cancer under the collar and breastbones last year. He told the panel he is one of 7 million cancer survivors. The hearing was held to demonstrate the need for more funding for cancer research. Funding in President Bush's fiscal 1992 budget is $802 million below what's been recommended by a panel of cancer experts. O'Neill says Americans would be outraged if they knew that money for research has been shrinking.
How many of the American people would really believe or would know that the Congress is appropriating less money for cancer today than they did in 1980? That'd be a shocker out there. They couldn't believe that.
The chairman of the committee, Ted Kennedy, said that although the National Institute of Health budget has grown, Cancer Institute funds have declined by 6%. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
The State Department said today that the U.S. will send blankets to Iran to help the Iraqi refugees there. The shipment will be carried by a U.S. Air Force cargo plane on Saturday. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the flight will be the first of several U.S. relief missions. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. When the United States began bombing Iraq on January 16th, only a handful of Americans had even heard of the Kurdish people who live in northern Iraq. Today, in the aftermath of Saddam Hussein's defeat and his subsequent bloody suppression of Kurdish rebels, the plight of the Kurds has become one of the great tragedies of the war. As many as 500 Kurds are said to be dying in mountain refugee camps daily. This morning's newspapers reported a possible accord between Hussein and Kurdish leaders that could allow the Kurds to return home and win a measure of autonomy. Robin Wright, a reporter in the Los Angeles Times Washington Bureau, has long experience in the Middle East. She says there's still not much reason to be hopeful about the Kurds' future.
Saddam Hussein has made many promises in the past and not followed through. This is an agreement only in principle. The details still have to be worked out. It strikes me that there are many obstacles in the path to a full agreement that is going to satisfy the Kurds and at the same time keep Saddam Hussein in power. The danger here is that that by allowing the Kurds autonomy in the north, he then paves the way for similar demands by the predominantly Shiite community in southern Iraq. There's another danger, and that is that the terms of autonomy include the use of the vast oil revenues generated in northern Kurdistan for Kurdish use rather than handing all of them over to the central government.
So what's that going to mean for Hussein's future then?
Well, Saddam Hussein is terribly in debt, which was one of the motivations for invading Kuwait in the first place. He was in debt before he went into the war, and now the damage is estimated between $100 and $150 billion to reconstruct Iraq out of what the UN calls a pre-industrial level. He also has debts ranging up to $40 billion to Europe and other Gulf countries, predating this crisis. And then on top of that, there's the issue of reparations to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia and potentially even Israel over the damage done during the Gulf War. So this is going to cost Saddam a lot, not only politically, but also financially at a time he needs money more than ever before.
So why is he smiling in the pictures that we see in Thursday's newspapers, kissing the cheeks of the Kurdish leader?
Saddam Hussein traditionally has done what has been politically expedient, made promises, be it to other countries or to his own people, and turned around and rather shrewdly slipped out of them. For example, in 1988, he and the Iranians agreed to the terms of a UN ceasefire to end the bloody eight-year Gulf War. To this day, however, he still has troops inside Iran, and there is no formal ceasefire. That was something he, 2 years after the original agreement last August, when he felt the pressure of the deployment by the United States and its coalition partners, agreed to finally formalize it to give the Iranians virtually everything they wanted. But 8 months after that, we still don't have a formal ceasefire to end the previous Gulf War. Saddam Hussein promises a lot, but as I said, rarely follows through with the full terms of the agreement. There's a real danger here that he could make promises to the Kurds. Many of them might go home, only to find that they're not getting what they promised, either politically, in terms of running an autonomous region in northern Iraq, or having the kind of revenues they need to support an autonomous government.
Well, but no one understands this better than the Kurds. I mean, they have a history of punctured promises from all sides, from the West, from Iran, from Iraq, from virtually everyone they've ever dealt with. So we're not talking about a naive set of people. You've reported from the Middle East since long before it was fashionable. Take us, if you can, a little more inside of what the expectations may be. Why would they be promoting this agreement, since they have plenty of reason to distrust it even more than you do?
Well, Talabani, one of the leaders who met with Saddam Hussein secretly over the last few days, came out and pointed out immediately that this was agreement only in principle and that the details would have to be worked out next week and probably beyond that. I think that we will probably get some kind of indication of how much the Kurds trust Saddam Hussein or even trust some of their own leaders when they make the decision about whether to go back inside Iraq. And that will be the real test. I just have some serious doubts about whether the Kurds will get what they want. And I think that there are probably suspicions. They're hopeful. They've been granted, told that they're going to get everything they want. But I think it may be months before we find out whether this is a real deal, a real change in the status of a community, the fifth largest ethnic group in the Middle East that has suffered not just repeatedly this century, but for centuries because they're divided between five states, and none of the five states want to give up any territory for fear that that will set a precedent that will then lead Kurds in neighboring communities to ask for the same thing, and it would break up the borders of five countries and potentially destabilize a whole region.
How do you see Saddam Hussein's future now? For some months we've been hearing that he has no future, that he will be destroyed. Now we see him negotiating with the Kurds. The Shiite minority in the southern part of Iraq seems to be displeased with these conversations going on between the Kurds and the Iraq and Hussein. Is Hussein pulling it out?
I think that there are a number of things that are pulling and tugging on Saddam. There are very few people, both inside Iraq and outside, who believe he's going to die a natural death in his bed. Most everyone assumes that he will be overthrown at some point. The issue is by whom and over what issues. The irony is that the Kurds and the Shiites, despite the fact they make up more than 70% of Iraq's population, have never been the ones who were strong enough, either politically or in terms of the arsenals in the hands of their opposition movements, to overthrow Saddam's regime. It was always going to take someone within his inner circle, one of three various parties, the military, the Revolutionary Command Council, or his own ruling Ba'ath Party, to move against him. I think for the time being, Saddam is bought some time, in part because of the uprising, which mobilized a lot of people within his own community, within the Sunni Muslim community, around him, because they feared the dangers of the Kurds and the Shia gaining some kind of control over the country. And so that the uprisings, which lasted between 3 weeks and a month, really gave him an opportunity after the war to reconsolidate his hold, not just on Iraq, but on large parts of the country. And he may, for the short term, have weathered the worst part of the storm. There are experts on the Kurds who believe that he could survive a couple of years or more now, that the issue that will be of the greatest challenge to him will be economic, because there are not many countries who are going to be willing to do business with Saddam Hussein on reconstruction, rebuilding oil refineries needed for revenue in that country, because that's the primary source of foreign exchange, well, as long as Saddam's in power. And the issue of sanctions that the United Nations make it very difficult immediately to begin rebuilding bridges, to restore electricity, to get phone lines going again. I mean, this is a country that really has incredible devastation to its infrastructure, and it will be the kind of slow economic squeeze that lead people within Saddam's circle to see that all of their plans to rebuild the country really are being stalled only because of one man, and at that juncture, they will move to replace him. The problem is there will probably be someone somewhat like him who takes over, which is not necessarily going to help the plight of the Kurds in the north, the Shia in the south, or Iraq's position as a single-party state.
Well, what should we be watching for in the next few weeks, and especially on this question of autonomy?
The details that still have to be worked out are pivotal in determining whether there really will be a truly autonomous Kurdistan in northern Iraq. And they center around the handover of political power. Who rules? Who are the governors in the provinces, the mayors in the cities? Are they pro-Saddam flunkies, or are they truly Kurds elected by their own people in democratic, free, and fair contests? The distribution of oil revenues in the Kurdish areas for use by the Kurds in developing the very poor north. The issue of...
Well, let's talk about the oil for a second. How can any nation permit one portion of its population to hold on exclusively to its most valuable resource?
Well, the argument by the Kurds has always been that the revenues from their part of the country have gone to the central government for its use rather than for building roads, clinics, schools, the basic things needed in that part of the country, and that they've gone for those issues, gone for those purposes, but to benefit rival communities. Or to help the state's intelligence apparatus, which then represses the Kurds in the north. So I think that the Kurds may not claim, again, there are no specifics in this arrangement. The Kurds may ask for a certain percentage of the oil revenues to be kept in Kurdistan for their use. But it's a very complex issue, and of course there's a real danger that if Saddam Hussein agrees to that he will then have to do something similar in the Shiite south, where another good chunk of his oil wells are. And if Iraq does that, then that opens the way for similar demands among other Gulf countries. For example, in Saudi Arabia, the Shiite are a minority, a very small minority, but they do occupy and work most of the oil fields. And there were riots 10 years ago over the issue of revenues from oil going to the central government in Riyadh rather than to build schools and clinics and roads and basic development projects in the eastern oil fields for the Shiite community. So this is a precedent that has very important weight, not only for throughout Iraq, but also throughout the Gulf.
Aside from oil interests and apportioning a certain amount of the oil from the Kurdish territories to Kurdish needs, what else would an autonomous Kurdish state mean? What would it look like?
An autonomous Kurdish state would really mean Kurds running Kurdistan, the northern provinces of Iraq, rather than Saddam Hussein's appointees. It would involve Kurds policing the area, administering social and social services. There would be no disagreement on foreign policy or currency and banking, but on all the key issues, it would in effect be like a state within the United States that has control over its own revenues and many of its own laws that may differ in terms of what Baghdad deems legal. It could become a de facto state if the Kurds are to get what they have been promised, which is one of the reasons I'm so skeptical. I can't imagine Saddam Hussein being willing to give up that much power. The game for him throughout the Gulf War was not just a game of absorbing the oil wealth of Kuwait. It was one of power in which he wanted to be the not only the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, but the dominant power in the 22-member Arab bloc. He wanted to be able to dictate everything from oil pricing to the terms for an Arab-Israeli peace. This is what his game has always been about. That was what his game was also in his invasion of Iran in 1980. So I think that the chances of Saddam Hussein really turning over enough power to satisfy the Kurds are highly unlikely, because it would go against everything he has fought his entire life to achieve.
Los Angeles Times reporter Robin Wright is a specialist in Middle Eastern affairs. This is Fresh Air. Lots of 20th century composers have used jazz and folk music in their compositions, but classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says that contemporary composer Meyer Kupferman has really absorbed these styles. Lloyd has a review of Kupferman's new album, Images of Chagall.
A short while ago, I received in the mail a compact disc of music by Meyer Kupferman. I knew his name, but not his music. The album was called Images of Chagall, and on the cover was Chagall's painting of the Green Violinist, the famous image of the giant fiddler perched on the rooftops of a Russian shtetl. Kupferman's Images of Chagall depicts five Chagall paintings in a lively circus atmosphere. The section called The Green Violinist serves as a melancholy interlude between more extroverted movements. I was especially touched by the haunting Yiddish folk tune. Here's the composer himself conducting the Bronx Arts Ensemble. Kupferman's fiddler on the roof is Gerald Tarek. Kupferman is a New Yorker. He was born in 1926 and attended the High School of Music and Arts and Queens College, and teaches at Sarah Lawrence. He's self-taught and has been quite prolific. He seems to have won practically every major music award short of the Pulitzer Prize. He's also a clarinetist with a great interest in jazz. What he calls his Gestalt style strikes me as a remarkably persuasive and effortless amalgamation of jazz and folk idioms with both traditional and contemporary classical techniques. Listen to part of Sound Phantoms No. 7, composed in 1980. It's a shifty, atmospheric 20-minute duet for wailing soprano sax and witty percussion, played by Stephen Mauch and Gordon Stout. Kupferman's summer music for flute, cello, and two amplified guitars has a little of the mellow, improvisatory feel of modern jazz on late-night FM radio. It's played by the Cygnus Ensemble with guitarists William Anderson and Oren Fader. My favorite of the three Kupferman pieces on this album is still Images of Chagall. The quirky chamber orchestra goes to extremes. The strings are violin and bass. The winds are clarinet and bassoon. The brasses, trumpet and bass trombone. And the percussion is, well, imaginative. The opening movement, Blue Circus, is all stripes and polka dots, though the clown face has an occasional tear. The E-flat clarinet is Chagall's tightrope walker, pirouetting dizzily on a high wire far above the crowd. The pleasure Kupferman's music gives is reflected in the obvious pleasure the musicians take in playing it. There are echoes of Stravinsky, Ravel, and Shostakovich, but the jazz and folk elements are so thoroughly assimilated, they transform those classical influences into a lively new sound world.
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. Myra Kupferman's new album, Images of Chagall, is on the Soundspells label. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest today, Japanese-American poet David Mura, grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, where he ate teriyaki but liked hot dogs better. As a sansei, a third-generation Japanese-American, he was far removed from the country of his ancestors. Coming up, Mura tells us how a chance trip to Japan helped him realize how much he was and was not Japanese. Also, photographer Annie Leibovitz is famous for her disarming photographs of the famous. John Lennon and Yoko Ono, Mick Jagger, and Tip O'Neill have all sat for her. A new retrospective of her work is on display. Commentator Maureen Corrigan has a review. That's coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Iraq's ambassador to the United Nations says that the police force in the northern town of Zaqo has been withdrawn, except for 50 officers. The White House and the allies had demanded that Iraq pull its security police out of the town, since Kurdish refugees were too frightened of them to come down out of the mountains for relief aid. Iraqi Ambassador Abdul Amir al-Anbari says the situation has been resolved to the satisfaction of all parties. The U.S. has not officially commented. In Iraq, senior United Nations officials and journalists came under gunfire from Kurdish guerrillas well inside Iraqi territory, but no one was badly hurt. From Baghdad, Bob Simpson filed this report for the BBC.
The United Nations officials and journalists had flown from Baghdad to Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq to look at possible locations for refugee aid stations. They had driven towards the Iranian border in Iraqi government cars with government drivers and had passed the last Iraqi checkpoint when the leading car approached a checkpoint apparently manned by armed Peshmerga guerrillas. The driver of the leading car, carrying the man in charge of the UN delegation, Bernd Bernander, reversed sharply and the guerrillas opened fire. They kept firing as the cars retreated and even gave chase in their own vehicle. A UN official and a journalist were slightly injured by flying glass from a smashed car window. A fellow journalist estimated that 500 rounds had been fired in 45 seconds and said the incident took place about 50 miles inside Iraq.
Bob Simpson reporting for the BBC from Baghdad. As Ethiopia's civil war moves closer to the capital of Addis Ababa, the U.S. State Department has ordered the evacuation of non-essential personnel and dependents from the American embassy there. The State Department is also warning private American citizens to leave the country. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
The State Department had already given permission for embassy dependents and non-essential personnel to leave voluntarily. Today, it ordered them out. The State Department had advised private Americans not to travel to Ethiopia. Today, the department urged those already in the country to leave. Department spokesman Richard Boucher.
The insurgent forces have made several recent advances around the capital of Addis Ababa. This makes the situation there very uncertain. And given that level of uncertainty, we believe it's prudent for U.S. citizens to leave.
Boucher said there are about 600 private U.S. citizens in Ethiopia. Most are missionaries or relief workers. The rebel advances are not expected to affect relief efforts in Ethiopia, which faces widespread hunger if emergency food cannot be delivered. In recent weeks, rebel and government authorities have been able to agree on food distribution systems despite the war. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 28 points today to close at 2921.04. Trading was active. This is NPR. The World Health Organization has released a survey on world mortality. It's found that Japanese women live the longest and Hungarians have the highest suicide rate. Also, more people who live in industrialized countries die from smoking rather from any form of violence. Venezuela now holds the record for the number of deaths from car accidents, while Great Britain has the lowest record. And malaria is thought to kill between 1 and 2 million people every year in developing nations. In Africa, 3 out of 4 malaria deaths occur in children younger than 5. 1 year after taking office, Nicaraguan President Violeta Chamorro has brought an end to the civil war in her country, but Nicaragua still faces a grave economic crisis. Vivian Altman has more from Managua.
Although the government argues that they've successfully consolidated freedom and democracy, most Nicaraguans are poorer than ever before. The U.S. has delivered less than half the promised congressional aid. This means that Nicaragua can't pay its old debts to the international banks. And that's not the only problem. A group of more than 100 ex-Contras have been staging attacks in the northern part of the country. Former Contra leader Franklin says some ex-Contras are being forced to use illegal methods. They haven't been given the land they were promised by the government. He says they're desperate. It's also been a year of drastic economic measures, strikes and fragile agreements. One thing sure, despite peace, there's a great deal more hunger, misery, and desperation. For National Public Radio, I'm Vivian Altman in Managua.
The head of Turkey's treasury says that Iraq is negotiating with his country to buy 1 million tons of wheat flour worth $200 million. The deal is likely to be completed next week. Baghdad's acceptance of a UN ceasefire resolution has ended restrictions on food imports. Baghdad has also asked the UN to sell about $1 billion worth of oil to pay its debts. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Frank Browning. David Mura is a poet. He lives in Minneapolis, and neither from his name nor his address would you know that his grandparents were all from Japan. Until he spent a year in Japan in 1984-85, Mura didn't spend much time thinking about his heritage or about why he had only gone out with non-Asian women, including his wife. But something deep inside him shifted after that year. It affected his sense of family, his sense of home, even his sense of body and sex. And he's written about it in a new book, Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei.
One of the things that I felt when I got to Japan and got off the airplane at Narita and saw everybody look like me was a feeling of surprise at how comfortable I felt in Japan and how much it meant to me that people around me looked like me, that when I turned on the TV, all the faces looked like mine, that everyone in the country, from the prime minister to the person on the subway, looked like me. And it gave me something to compare with what I felt in America, which was often a feeling of vague alienation or feelings of being different. And I think that I felt a certain amount of anger about how much that those feelings of alienation had been discounted or ignored by American culture.
Well, you talk about masks and the need to find masks and to discard masks and to remove the internal anger with another sort of expression.
Well, I think that my story goes back all the way to the relocation camps and what happened to my parents. When the Japanese Americans were put into the relocation camps, they were really put in there because they were Japanese Americans, not because they had done anything. There was no Japanese American who was ever convicted of espionage. And the way I like to talk about that experience is that if you are put into a prison because you're a shoplifter and you come out and you are a reformed shoplifter, what is it that you do? You don't shoplift anymore. So what happens if you're put into prison for being of Japanese ancestry? You come out, and the implicit message is if you're going to be reformed, if you don't want to be put in prison again, you don't call attention to the fact that you're of Japanese ancestry. Now, when my father was in the camps, a white teacher told him, you will get out of the camps and after the war, and you'll be back in American society. But for your sake, you should try to be not just one, but 200% American. And I think my father took that to be, I will try to be white middle-class American. I will really not try to call attention to anything in my Japanese background. And I think that's the way that he raised us. So that I think both from my parents and from the culture, I got a sense of, on the surface of, let's not talk about Japanese culture and let's pretend that we really don't want to call attention to ourselves as Japanese. And beyond that, I think a sense of self-neglect and self-hatred about and shame about my Japanese ancestry.
That's the David Mura who went to Japan.
I think the David Mura who went to Japan, therefore, was somebody who really, in certain ways, didn't want to go to Japan, didn't want to be reminded of the fact that he had Japanese ancestors. I speak at the beginning of the book how when I won this fellowship to go to Japan, part of me wished that the prize was Paris, not Tokyo. And I say that I would have preferred French bread and brie over sashimi and rice and Roland Barthes over D.T. Suzuki and Zen.
Is that still true?
No, I don't think so. What happened once I got there was I think I fell in love with Japanese culture and with being in Japan and with felt this tremendous sense of pride, both in the tremendous contemporary hustle and bustle of Tokyo and this brilliant neon city, and also in various ancient parts of Japanese culture that I saw either touring or when I was in Japan, I studied the medieval Japanese drama No, which is still practiced today.
Your discoveries sound a lot like black people who went to Africa in the late 60s and discovered a world they really hadn't quite imagined. Even like gay people who went to San Francisco and suddenly found these new families.
Mm-hmm.
And your intellectual background is largely shaped by Frantz Fanon and others. How different is this search for a home from other subgroups in America, racial or otherwise?
Well, I think one difference is that I think it's nearly impossible to imagine American culture without Afro-Americans. You simply cannot imagine it. Whereas I think it is possible for people to think about American culture without thinking about Japanese Americans. So that the second thing is obviously there is a more virulent racism against Afro-Americans in this country. So there's a sense for them of both being a stronger part of the cultural fabric and yet at the same time being discriminated against on a greater level. The Japanese Americans have been sort of known as a sort of good, quiet, model minority. And I think that model was based on a thinking which said, don't call attention to yourself, try to blend in, try to, in essence, be as middle-class white as you can.
Well, many white Americans are inclined to say, surely there are abuses of race and class with many people, certainly with African Americans, with Latinos often, with Filipinos. But for Chinese Americans and Japanese Americans, there's certainly no income abuse by and large. Why should there be such an identification? And for Japanese Americans, they say that there's a great mixing that goes on. So, I mean, I think there is a puzzlement on the part of white people in this country.
Yeah, and I think that puzzlement is due to a lack of white imagination, and in part also because certain aspects of Chinese and Japanese American experience have not really been expressed in a wide way in the culture, and that is because they are not in control of what is shown and what is done in the culture. Even when Ellen Parker did the film Come See the Paradise, what had to happen was you had to have Dennis Quaid, a white guy, as the hero of the movie about Japanese Americans being interned in the relocation camps. And there was an assumption there that even when you are telling a story of Japanese Americans, they are secondary to the white male who is the center of consciousness of that film. I think one of the things that both the Japanese Americans and the Chinese Americans share is a history of racism in this country, which is often not told. When you look, for instance, at the photograph of the railroads meeting east and west, what you see is a number of white faces. You don't see any of the Chinese who actually did the majority of the work on building that railroad. So that I think that part of the success, if Japanese Americans have moved into middle class, is because they have minimized their sense of difference, have tried to hide it. And I think one of the things that is changing now about a definition of what it means to be an American is that the object is not necessarily to meld in, to pretend you're like everybody else, but to say, I can be American, I can have come from a different cultural background, from a different history, and that history and that cultural background and the way that I look at the world is important, and it is American.
My guest is David Miura. He's the author of a new book, Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei. We'll be back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is David Miura. He is a writer, a poet, who spent a year in Japan thinking about his Japanese and his American identity. David, this sense of your connection to Japan and your wife's increasing distance, it seems like, during the time you were there, is something you write about. You talk about how you were walking down the street one day with another friend, and well, maybe you can tell us what happened.
Well, I'm walking down the street with them, and with my wife, who's a Caucasian, and my friend Daniel, who's a corporeal mime, who's 6'2", and does stand out above the Tokyo crowds, and we come to a stoplight, and they begin to jaywalk, and they are jaywalking in part because they're playing on what we used to call a gaijin license, a foreigner's license. And that was that if you were a foreigner, you could pretend as if you didn't really know the Japanese rules. And so you could break the rules with a sense of impunity. And as they walk across the street jaywalking, I realize that if I jaywalk with them, even though I am a foreigner too, everybody will think that I'm Japanese. And so I don't jaywalk across the street, and they kid me for being, you know, for being so stuffy and playing along with the Japanese rules, and I sit there and sort of chide them and say, you Americans, you think you own the world, and it's a curious sort of feeling as I watch them walk across the intersection and stand there at the other side waving me on, and my not feeling as if I could jaywalk, that I had to stand there with the Japanese crowd. And what I realized as I saw my wife over there with my friend Daniel was that there was a sort of gulf which had opened up between us in terms of who we were in Japan and the ways that our racial backgrounds had affected, you know, how we looked at ourselves in that country.
David, this book is a lot about the body. Mm-hmm. Enormous amounts of its energy is given over, of your energy in writing about it is given over to thinking about your body. You talk about the eczema you suffered as a child, your sense of skin difference, the theater that you worked with, the dance theater there was very, very physical. It's a little unusual in these kinds of memoirs of looking of racial difference and of cultural difference to be so focused on the body.
I think that the fact of talking about the body and skin color and the ways that those things affect your identity is something which oftentimes is really taboo in this society. Sometimes in the book I talk about little things about the body. For instance, I don't drink here and in the States, and one of the reasons why I don't drink much is because I turn red when I drink, and I found that after one drink I turn beet red, and everybody sort of points at me and laughs, and I feel embarrassed. And when I got to Japan and I go out drinking with Japanese friends, I'd look around and everybody around the table was all beet red, so I didn't have to feel odd. But beyond that, I think I was so struck when I got there, as I said before, with how it felt to look like everybody and to be able to meld into the crowd.
How did you come up with your choice of titles for the memoir, Turning Japanese?
What the book charts in a way is the way in which I fall in love with Japan, and by the middle of the book, I feel like I'm turning Japanese. Everything around me, the food that I'm eating, the music that I'm listening to, what I'm speaking, I don't really want to think about going back to America. I don't really want to even think about American literature very much.
But as I understand it, the phrase also has another slang meaning in this country, and you're probably not unaware of it.
Well, actually, it's not in this country. It is a British slang term, and I was aware of it, and I really don't want people to think about it as they think about the title. It is a British slang term for masturbation, and it's a racist slang term, which is based on the idea that if you masturbate, your eyes sort of become slits. I tested the title on a number of people, and I found that most people, some people had heard that there was a pop song in the early 80s that was called Turning Japanese, and some young people had heard that song and knew that. Most people that I talked to, my experience may be different, did not know the meaning of this British slang term.
Thanks for being with us. My guest has been David Mura. He is the author of Turning Japanese, Memoirs of a Sansei. Robert Siegel is with us from All Things Considered. What's in the news today, Robert?
Well, Frank, we'll hear today about Mikhail Gorbachev's remarkable feat of political survival this week by aligning himself with Boris Yeltsin and other leaders of the republics, people who were often his adversaries. The Soviet president appears to have avoided a challenge to his leadership of the Communist Party at this week's meeting of the Central Committee. We'll hear about that. Also, a talk with Ephraim Karsh, author of a new political biography of Saddam Hussein, who addresses such questions as what's the difference between Saddam Hussein and Adolf Hitler. And we'll also hear from Mike Schuster with a report about why so many in Western Europe, with the Cold War over, feel less safe today than they did a few years ago.
Those and other stories coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's pretty hard not to have seen the work of photographer Annie Leibovitz. Over the past 20 years, her portraits of famous people have been showing up on the pages of Vanity Fair and Rolling Stone, and in ads for American Express and The Gap. A retrospective exhibit of Leibovitz's work is now on view at the National Portrait Gallery in Washington. Critic Maureen Corrigan saw the show and has this review.
Annie Leibovitz says that she collaborates with her subjects to create quintessential photographic portraits of them. But I wonder if any of the celebrities that Leibovitz has photographed are ever disturbed when they see the final product of this joint collaboration. It's not that her photographs are cruel or ugly, but Leibovitz has such a gift for convincing famous people to let down their guard that they often wind up mocking their own public images in her photographs. It's a kind of double exposure effect where we see the familiar faces of the famous and at the same time see them disassembling their images. Arnold Schwarzenegger, for instance, is smoking a cigar in his portrait. He's dressed in skin-tight riding breeches, and he's sitting astride a muscular horse. It's Arnold poking fun at other phallic symbols, and also acknowledging his own status as a film stallion. Robert Penn-Warren posed shirtless for Leibovitz in 1980, forcing viewers to look at his old man's chest, and for once, not to think of him as a disembodied great writer. And Donald and Ivana Trump must have a hidden streak of self-deprecation that only Leibovitz has tapped. In 1988, she photographed them dressed in gaudy evening clothes. Almost everything here, including Ivana's hair, is tinted the color of fool's gold. Leibovitz has a touch of Diane Arbus in her, a taste for the bizarre that's evident when she photographs celebrities stuck in weird substances. Leibovitz is trying to find visual symbols to represent the strange element of fame that surrounds these people. Lauren Hutton, Sting, Roseanne Barr, and her husband Tom Arnold are smeared in mud for their official portraits. Leibovitz shot Whoopi Goldberg in a white bathtub filled with what I think is milk. Whoopi's brown legs, arms, and laughing face pop out of this primordial vanilla ooze. She's like a black and white soda from the Twilight Zone ice cream parlor. Leibowitz's most striking talent is her ability to construct a narrative in her photographs. This exhibition shows you how her stories have grown more complex. Her first professional assignment, at age 20, was a picture of John Lennon for Rolling Stone magazine. It's a simple, melancholy portrait of his face. 10 years later, on December 8, 1980, Leibowitz took the last photos ever taken of Lennon 2 hours before he was murdered. They're the famous fetal images of Lennon naked, nestled up against a fully clothed Yoko, and they speak volumes about the dynamics of their relationship. In a 1975 photo, Mick Jagger testifies to the proverbial hardships of being on the road. He stands in a hotel elevator, dressed only in a terry cloth robe, with a towel wrapped around his sour face. He looks like the kind of man you don't get into elevators with. And soccer star Pelé's career is captured in a witty close-up of his feet. Their calluses and torn toenails give us a play-by-play description of every goal he's ever made. Every Leibowitz picture tells a provocative story, whether it's about the greed of the Gilded 80s or our need to turn other people into icons of our own desires.
Maureen Corrigan teaches at Georgetown University. The exhibit, Annie Leibowitz Photographs 1970 to 1990, is in Washington until August and then moves to several other American and European cities. Danny Miller is our senior producer. Fresh Air is engineered this week by Audrey Vablaitis, Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Roberta Sharrock directed today's show. I'm Frank Browning. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
New York Times reporter Stephen Kinzer spent 13 years watching revolution and economic collapse in Nicaragua. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Kinzer about the dream that went sour. I'm Frank Browning, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.